My name is Tarek, and I am a recovered addict.
Hey, Tarek.
And we thank you for joining us this afternoon. We're going to have four sessions. Our intent is to show sponsors how to take somebody through the big book without going through line by line, but still moving them quickly through the 12-step process. Intuitively, I think we all have been in a situation, those of us who have sponsored, where we sit down, we have an initial meeting, and something inside of you, your sixth sense, says to you, I got to get this guy through this process really quick or I'm going to lose him. But a lot of us, the only way we know was what was done with us, which was line by line. That's how I went through the process initially. So sponsorship for me has become an art form that we have that's been crafted. And this is a new technique that Scott and I work with. Scott mentioned it a while back that he didn't take everybody through the book line by line. Intuitively, your spirit will speak to you, and you'll be able to move them through a process that can get them access to power, which will create their personality change. And so we're going to blast right off. I'm going to roll for about 22 minutes, 24 minutes, and then Scott's going to go on for 25, and we'll take a five-minute break. Yes, Miss Dot?
Did you read the amended statement?
I didn't.
Did you read the amended statement?
No, ma'am.
Is that up there on board?
No, ma'am. No, we're not. You know, we're just going to blast off into our workshop right now. So that's what we're going to do right now.
What was the amended statement?
Do you know it by heart?
I thought it was up there.
No, it's not up here. And so what we're going to start with is the blank page, the title page of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the initial discussion I'm going to have with a new guy as I'm taking him through this work. Is I want to talk about the spiritual significance of the circle and triangle, that we have a three-part problem and we have a threefold program. We have the recovery piece, which is the application of the first 11 steps. I have a unity piece, which is carrying my body to the fellowship, the first layer of healing that takes place is when we share our common experience with the problem. The mind goes through the recovery process, and the way my spirit grows is when I sit down one-on-one, work the steps with another member of a Cocaine Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get to watch the light go on, and my spirit gets caught up in that exchange of energy. And so now I've learned how to adapt recovery into my personal life. I've got unity, which to me is very deep in accountability and transparency with a group of men in your network, as well as the home group, and having a job at your group, and going to group conscience on a regular basis. And the only service work that the Big Book talks about is service to our spirit through the 12th step and working with others. I believe when I set up a meeting, or I clean up after a meeting, or I take guys to the meeting, I think that's service for our fellowship, which is under unity. It continues to keep us unified. That's the initial conversation I want to have with someone new that I'm taking through this process. Circle and triangle. You hear people talk about the magic formula. That's the formula: recovery, unity, and service. Afterwards, we're going to talk about this word recovered, because in this weekend, you know, I was here yesterday and today, I hear a lot of people say I'm recovering. Now, the Big Book doesn't use the word recovering unless it's talking about the family in the chapter to the wives and the family afterward. I have taken the action necessary to arrest my addiction, meaning I don't think about crack cocaine and alcohol anymore. Therefore, I don't put them in my body to activate the abnormal physical reaction. I'm in a recovered state, and I can stay in a recovered state by continuing to work these steps on a regular basis for me. My spirit is fed. The mental obsession does not return. Now, what I think people mean when they say they're recovering is a spiritual malady, and I get that. That's what we're always going to be in a state of recovery with. The internal condition, if it completely recovered, I would be floating around this room with a halo on my head. I'd never have any resentment. It just would not exist. There would be no fear. That would be someone that's completely recovered from a spiritual malady. Unless you're a saint or an angel or some form or manifestation on that level, you're going to have some of this internal condition stuff going on. And so we do recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So we go from this title page. I go to the forward, I believe, to the first edition, and we talk about what is it that we recover from. It's simple. It's laid out there. We have a conversation about the mental obsession when you're in a in a position of neutrality, the illusion that you have a choice is no longer there. It's not like I woke up today and said, I'm not smoking crack. It just wasn't one of my options for how to start my day because I'm in a fit spiritual condition. So that's page X, triple I. I believe I'm in a fourth edition here. I think I am. So that's the conversation. From there, I want to go to the forward to the second edition. There's a story of Bill and Bob. I consider myself a little bit of a historian, so I tell the whole story. I'm not going to tell it this morning, but I do want to engage them in a conversation that shows them why we're all sitting here at a CA convention in the year 2016. How is it we all ended up here? It's really important that you share that if you have that in your wheel shed. The next thing I want to talk about with a new guy is this idea that the work here proves that one addict and one non-alcoholic and one non-addict alcoholic can affect each other like no non-addict or non-alcoholic can. So it's imperative that you begin to have a conversation about the identification. I'm a cocaine addict at heart. I like to work with cocaine addicts. Does that mean I can't sponsor a heroin addict or a crystal meth addict? No. What that means is I'm really clear on what I am, and I'm most effective with a cocaine addict. If guys come to me, they're heroin, they're crystal meth, they're alcohol. Well, I've sponsored enough guys. I've been around long enough now where, you know, I think it might be more effective for you to work with this person because of that identification. We're going to touch on that a little bit later. The next sentence or the says, it also indicates that strenuous work, one addict with another, one alcoholic with another, is vital for permanent recovery. So at this point, this is where I have my conversation about the one day at a time that you hear in the meetings. I've been taught that the one day at a time principle applies when you're talking about confronting life's day-to-day challenges. We learn how to do that on a day-to-day basis. But if you work the steps as outlined in the big book, and you begin to carry the message and you establish recovery, unity, and service, you will have permanent recovery. I guarantee that to every guy I sponsor. A lot of people say there are no guarantees in the program. I don't believe that. The big book says if I do this work, I'll have permanent recovery. A lot of us think when we go through the steps individually, that's the work. I used to believe that. I no longer believe that. When I go back through the steps, it's prep work for the real work. And the real work is to sit down one-on-one and show another man how to have a personal relationship with a God of his understanding using the 12 steps. That's how I present this concept of one day at a time when I'm taking people through the steps. And we're going to move into the doctor's opinion. You can see that we're covering a lot of ground, but we're not reading line by line. So we can get to the meat of this program and the basic considerations and questions we have to ask. In the doctor's opinion, I have to ask the question, especially with the cocaine addict, because the physical craving that they talk about for the cocaine addict is very different than the physical craving for the heroin addict. For the cocaine addict, it's not like our body needs more crack cocaine. But what happens is the mind is part of the body. And we take that first hit of crack cocaine and the mind instantly changes. It has an abnormal reaction. It's literally just been hijacked. And so I get really clear with cocaine addicts that I'm working with that it's a different type of physical craving. Because the opiate addiction and the heroin addiction turns into the physical body must have it. Well, my mind's part of my physical body, and it tells me that I have to have it. It's no longer the obsession, because now I've introduced cocaine into my system. And so for years, I just thought I was making a choice. After I took that first one, I'm choosing over and over to keep smoking. And that just, when I look at my experience, that's not what happened. I activated a fire inside of me, in my brain, that sent me down this spree, and the fire burns out when the fire burns out. So on page XXVI in the fourth edition, it says that the body of an addict or the body of an alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. I'm sure those of you that have engaged in sponsorship know this is sometimes very difficult for an addict or alcoholic to see, so we have to draw it out of their experience. And then the next paragraph, the last sentence, it explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. So I don't know about you guys, but when I showed up here, I thought I had my moral compass was way off. I thought I was a horrible choice maker, and I really thought I was a bad person for the things I had done to the people in my life. And when I finally understood, based on my experience, what this physical craving is actually saying, I could finally account for all the family functions that I didn't show up for. I could finally account for all the job responsibilities that I did not show up for, all the relationships that I was not present for. It made sense. I wasn't a bad person. I wasn't a quote, you know, a piece of shit like my mind told me for years. Now, does that mean I can go to my family and say, you know what, Mom? I had a physical reaction to the cocaine, and that's why I didn't show up to all those functions. No. The only thing that the world needs to know is, hey, I'm taking ownership of my actions. I'm taking responsibility for my life. I don't want to engage in this behavior anymore. I've harmed you. I regret it. What can I do to make it right? That's all that works. But for us, we have a lot of guilt and shame. And when a guy you're taking through the steps understands out of his own experience what the loss of control after we start does to him, then he gets free of guilt and shame and the self-loathing. I'm amazed by the amount of men who have relapsed. Maybe they weren't even sponsored by me, but we have a discussion, and they'll say they wanted to get high more than they wanted to stay sober. You've completely misunderstood it. And I've got one guy in my life that really has an extreme amount of self-loathing behind all of that, which I think keeps him in active relapse. And so when you are able to show someone what loss of control does, and it starts to explain many things for which we cannot otherwise account. So this is an important discussion to have. The next discussion I'm going to have is on the top of XXVIII. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of cocaine and other mind-altering substance on these chronic addicts and alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So here I always tell a story. You know, I had a couple of guys out. I was, you know, two of my boys were at a bar. We've lost control of them out. We're drinking. We're all intoxicated. We all have this extreme desire to start doing some cocaine. And so I said, you know what? I can go down to North Avenue and Boulevard. Let's pull our money together. Let's go back to my house. So we get a couple slabs. We go back to my house, and we're sitting around, and we're puffing away, and the slabs are gone. And they are content with sitting there and just drinking and smoking some pot. And me, I'm pacing through the whole house. I'm just trying to slam liquor down to the point where I can get in my car and go back downtown. And eventually I got in my car, went back downtown, and I stayed downtown. The effect produced in them was entirely different than the effect produced in me. And so I have that conversation here. You know, there's a part of the mind that engages in the possibility of maybe one day I'll have a reaction like theirs. But I have to be really grounded in this idea that I don't have the same reaction. I've heard people say before that everyone that smokes crack is instantly a cocaine addict. It's just not true. I just shared with you a personal experience that proves that's not true. And so we do have to talk about what reaction or effect is produced in you, which is go into the next paragraph that we're going to cover at the bottom of the page. It says, Tarek and Scott, men and women, does not say addicts and alcoholics. Drink and use essentially because they like the effect produced by cocaine and alcohol. This feeling is so elusive. What happens between the second and the fifth drink or that first blast is so elusive that while they admit it ultimately creates consequences that injure them, they cannot after a time tell you what's true and what's false. They can't tell the difference between what alcohol and drugs are doing to them and for them. They've lost it. There's no line of demarcation there. To them, the addict life seems the only normal one. They are restless or uneasy, irritable or discontented. I call that easily annoyed by people around you and dissatisfied with life. Unless we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking, for me, 2 to 5 drinks or 1 hit of crack cocaine. And believe it or not, hits of crack cocaine and drinks, which I sometimes see other people taking without any consequence. After they've succumbed to the desire, again, and so many of us do, this abnormal physical reaction develops and we pass through a well-known stages of a run. We come out of it with that little tear coming out of your eye, looking in the mirror in the hotel room. I'm never going to do this again. I'm so sick of living this way. And I make a firm resolution not to smoke crack cocaine. And I repeat this over and over because 8 hours later, I'm smoking crack cocaine again. And unless this person can experience an entire personality change or psychic change, there's very little hope of their recovery. And so this is where I talked to them about, I went to treatment, I was a chronic relapser 3 years, 2 trips to treatment, 3 sober living programs, and every single place I went to focused on behavior modification, right? You hang out with people that are in recovery, you go to meetings, you stick with the winners, you're of service, and you talk about your feelings. That's what we did. And what happened was the behavior was modified until you put me back in the real world and nothing had been changed about my personality or my thinking, right? So our thoughts are eventually born into words. Words are eventually turned into actions. You do things long enough, you form habits. Habits, a group of habits are your behaviors and your character, and the path you travel is based on that. And so every time I was dipped into recovery on that level, into the treatment program, I was dipped into behavior modification. The 12-step process changes. It requires your thinking process to change. And I'll tell you where the magic happens for the addict or alcoholic. The thinking begins to change when you start to live between the third and fourth column. Between the third and fourth column of your inventory, that was why the list holds the key to our future. And we're going to get to that later. But this is the conversation I have with a newcomer around the importance of the thinking process being changed. And we can't change our thinking. I don't believe you can fake it till you make it. I just don't believe that. That wasn't my experience. Now, I think that works for some people. They've been around and they continue to say it, so evidently it works. I don't know anything about it. Next, we're going to move into the best teaching example for when you're trying to dig out the physical craving out of someone. The best teaching example you can use is the bottom of page XXIX. It says, I do not hold with those who believe that addiction is entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date in their favor. They took a hit of crack cocaine or a drink of alcohol or a shot of dope a day or so prior to the date, and the phenomenon of craving, the physical reaction, abnormal reaction, at once became paramount to all other interests. So the important appointment was not met. These men are not drinking or getting high to escape. They're drinking and getting high to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. And so I'll go, these are the questions I ask. Hey, did you have a work function where it was really important for you to be at the work function and you picked up a drink or a drug maybe a few hours before or a day before and you missed it? Did you have any birthdays, any outings with your kids, any holidays with your family where you wanted to be there, you didn't want to be messed up, and you picked up a drink prior to having to be there? And what you intended to have happen did not have happen. And what I do is I share my stories about the proverbial happy hour. You know, somebody would come by my office. This was 2004 to 2006. Let's go get a couple of drinks after work. And that was part of my delusion that I actually thought I was going to have a couple of drinks. I go to the bar. Effect produced in me is way different, right? Addicts and alcoholics, see, normal people, they're taken to the edge of a cliff and they know they're at the edge of the cliff. And that's when they tap the brakes. Addicts and alcoholics, we don't even stop, man. You know, we're getting there and we jump every single time. We jump off the cliff. And so I have to show them that bodily they are powerless once they start to use. And that's the best way I can pull an example of the physical craving out. What important engagements have you missed because you started drinking before you were supposed to be there? Over and over. That you can just stick with that tool right there and you will show someone their loss of control once they start. We're going to move on now to one thing I do want to touch on that I didn't, the ease and comfort. alcohol and drugs did a lot for us. If they had not, they would not have done so much to us. And so you have to talk to them about the 12-step process, the psychic change, and the personal relationship with the God of their understanding has to create the same ease and comfort. It has to. Otherwise, we're not going to hang out. And I'm ripping my buddy Carl off again, but a few weeks ago I heard him explain it unlike any way I've ever heard it explained. But what happens to us between the second and the fifth drink and that first hit of crack cocaine, if we could box that up and stay there, we would always be there. It's pure ecstasy. And so what has to happen in this process has to override that. But the deal is, the thinking mind wants to compare the two, but you can't. It's like comparing apples and oranges. But what happens here is the magic, when you get bit by the magic bug and you stay active in this work, it has a residual effect, right? So there are a few people that walked into this room, and every time I'm in your presence, there's some type of residual effect because I've watched you transform. I've watched you change. And that was God. That's how I witnessed God. And so it creates all that. Now imagine you multiply that by all the people you sponsor and all the people that they sponsor. And every time you're in their presence, it shows you the power of God. And that's always going to be enough to override that mind telling you that I need to go back to this area between the second and fifth drink and the first hit of crack cocaine. That's what has to happen here if you want a permanent recovery. You got to get bit by the bug. And the only way I can guarantee you're going to get bit by the bug is take someone through the steps and watch them change. I think that's all I want to cover in the doctor's opinion. We're going to go to page 5 in Bill's story. As you guys see, there's no line by line here. We're just moving through the book trying to have certain conversations with people we're sponsoring. Now, this is all being taped. I suggest maybe highlighting these paragraphs in your book, but don't take the notes. It's going to be taped. Go back and listen to it after. So, page 5, Bill's story. Very important that we talk about the crack cocaine, crystal meth, heroin, alcohol ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. And then I skipped down to the last sentence in that paragraph. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation. There were periods of sobriety and clean time which renewed my wife and family's hope. Skip down another paragraph, two paragraphs. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I could not smoke crack anymore. I couldn't take so much as one blast or one drink. I was through forever. Before that, I'd written a lot of sweet promises. I made a lot of firm resolutions. My family sometimes observed that this time I meant business. I would have passed a lie detector test. And so I did, but I didn't. So here we go. The conversation that you have to have here is, did you have these moments of clarity where you realized you couldn't take so much as one drink? You couldn't do one key bump. And then it's easily replaced by the old threadbare idea that my reaction this time will be different, right? I'm not going to go on a 3-day run. I'm going to smoke crack Friday and Saturday, and then I'm going to chill out on Sunday, and I'm going to go to work on Monday. Does that sound familiar to anybody? But I knew there was something deep down in me those last 3 years that knew it had to be stopped. And I began to move my way to that state of consciousness we call hopelessness, right? I want to stop, but I can't stop. I don't have the power to stop. And then I want to stay stopped, but I keep going back. I can't stay away from it, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. And so these are the conversations that I want to have on this page, page 5. At what point did this become the only life I had ever known? And part of what keeps me here is I don't know any other way of living, right? I lived in a drug culture. As part of my story, I was around, the whole jam band scene and the Grateful Dead and Widespread Panic and Phish. And you live a certain way for a long enough period of time and it becomes the only normal one, like the doctor's opinion says. This is the conversation I have with this concept. And so you can sit with a person you're taking through the steps and just focus for 15, 20 minutes on this page. But what's really important is you're not convincing them based on your experience. You have to convince them based on their experience. And for a while, and I'm gonna let Scott's gonna take over here. for a while I was using my experience to convince people they were like me. I can't do that. It's not an effective process. You have to use your experience to pull out of their experience. It will solidify the first step for them. And with that, I give you my pal, Mr. Scott.
Thank you, Tarek. Hey, everybody, I'm Scott, and I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. Hey. Great job, T. Thank you so much. So, you know, Tarek spoke a little bit to asking questions. That no matter where I'm working with you, whether we're going to go through kind of on a crash course to get through this thing fast because you're the guy that needs to get through it, or whether we're going to sit down and go line by line week after week, I'm going to ask a whole lot of questions around the first step and second step, and really in the first step, right? We got 53 pages of this book, more or less, that are focused on step one. So I need to, instead of reading it line by line to you, I need to be asking you questions so that you can reconcile whether this is true in your own experience. That's always the deal. I'm not so much into convincing you. It doesn't matter to me, right? Like, I'm there to carry a message to you, and I think you can convince yourself if I ask the questions properly and you go into your own experience to locate what your truth is, right? Because I need to be moved into my own first step experience, right? And I don't need to be forced. And trust me, you take one of us and try to force us to do something, and we're going to say black just because you said white, even if our life depends on us saying white, right? That's how it is. So, where'd you wrap up here with 104?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, if we move over to page 6 and Bill's story, look at paragraph 1. So, here's the, you know, we've just talked with a guy. We've helped him to locate some of his own experience around when did you wake up, right? When did you see that this had to be stopped and you realized that you just couldn't live this way anymore, you couldn't do this anymore, you were going to try to control, manage, have some power around it, right? Well, when did that fail? When is the next time, or did the next time after that, did you have a failing of that commitment, of that firm resolution that Tarek just talked about, right? The way the book puts it is here, the paragraph begins with remorse. So the remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity, right? Have you ever woken up from a run and felt impending doom? Have you been just riddled with fear, terrified about what happened the night before, right? If you have, you're welcome home, right? I mean, you're in the right place because that's how it is, right? And I love turning statements into questions, right? Did your brain race uncontrollably, right? Right? I love that question. So he says, then I hardly dared cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck. For scarcely daylight, you know, that's kind of Bill's personal experience. But then, after you had all this happen, even after this awareness, after this suffering, this pain, did you wake up? Did you go back in and take another drink? Did you go back in and take another hit of dope, right? The end of this says, you know, that was, so the market would recover, but I wouldn't. You know, back then Bill was talking about the stock market collapse at 29. He said, oh, hell, the market will recover, but I will not. See, there's this moment of, did you ever feel hopeless? Did you feel like you were done? Like you knew you couldn't stop drinking. You knew you couldn't stop doing dope. Right? Did you have that experience? Right? All right. Did you ever have thoughts of killing yourself? Right? All of us just about will go, oh, yeah. Why didn't us? Why are we sitting here now? We didn't, right? Because most of us did exactly this. We went, nah, killing myself sounds all right, but another hit of dope sounds better, right? So I go, it's not like it's that kind of a logical train of thought, but if you look back on it, you can find that you had experiences like that. Completely miserable with the intolerable situation of your life as it was, but unable to pull the trigger, so to speak, right? So we do what we think we'll do. Gin would fix that, right? Crack cocaine will fix that. Heroin will fix that. So then a couple of hits and then oblivion. So then we're going to move over to page 8. And here's where, of course, Bill has his first step experience, right? There's a powerful, powerful experience that occurs here. And we are attempting to move a new guy towards what we're going to get to on page 30, right? And Tarek, one of us will be there at page 30. But there's a complete admission of inner defeat. That is our step one, right? And we're trying to move towards that. So We look here at page 8 where he says, first full paragraph, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. You know, have you felt loneliness and despair like nothing you can describe? Right? Have you been overwhelmed by self-pity in the midst of this life you lived? Right? Do you ever feel like quicksands stretched around you in all directions? Have you met your match, right? Has cocaine, has heroin, has whiskey become your master? And I love this. I love this question, right? What throne did you serve at? Did you serve at the throne of King Crack Cocaine? Did you serve at the throne of heroin? Because I know what a guy's thing is, right? I know by the time at this point, we've pretty much identified what a guy will run you over to get before anything else, right? Or a gal, whether it be whatever the drug of no choice is. Right? And we really want to get that visual because there's a powerful experience in getting one of us to get connected to that I've served a master, right? That I've gone out, kind of like Carrick talked about a minute ago. You know, the things I've done, all of the commitments I've broken, all the people I've hurt. I've sponsored a bunch of people over the years, and I have not sponsored one sociopath, right? But I've sponsored a bunch of us that look like sociopaths. Right? Myself included, I've been shown that I look like a sociopath, right? But it's not that, right? We serve at the throne of the master. If we're really the real McCoy, if we're truly powerless, and we do what it tells us to do, we go where it tells us to go, we drop who it tells us to drop, and we have with us who we're supposed to have with us, right? That's serving at the throne of the master. So really spending some time with a guy right here will get a guy connected to their truth around this. And it's very important. Okay? So we're going to move over to page 12. All right, so here's where, so that's a delineating mark in Bill's story, right? Where quickstrand stretches all around Bill, where we really get to this serving the master part. And Bill's story takes a turn because that's the surrender for Bill. Shortly after that, he drank one more time. Then he got sober and he stayed sober for once and for all, right? So we start moving towards what Bill did to get sober, right? What Bill did to get sober, to stay sober, what his experience looked like. So we're going to start talking to a guy as we move through this part, and we've helped him understand what's going on with Bill, had his surrender experience, how that relates to him, how he can reconcile his own experience with it. Then we're going to talk a little bit about what is going to have to be done to get out from under, right? What's going to have to be done to experience freedom, to not serve the master, but to serve something new. All right. So, page 12, paragraph 2. So, of course, we know Ebby has come to talk to Bill. He says, despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. So, we're going to talk a little bit about God right here. We're going to say, hey, Bill, somebody showed up to this guy and said, hey, you're going to have some power to get sober and stay sober, and it's going to have to be a power greater than yourself. And Bill said, yeah, whatever. I don't know about all that business, right? I don't know if I can quite get down with that. So we're going to share that with the guy, right? Book goes on to say, when the thought was expressed there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence or universal mind or spirit or nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I've since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. So this may be the truth for the guy. We want to ask him, what's your current experience? You know, do you believe there's a power? Do you have a power? What is that? We just want to get some information from him, right? We're starting to locate a little bit about what this guy's belief is, or this gal. I keep saying, guy, don't take it personal. It's, you know what I mean. Because I know the ladies. I want you to know. I want it to be personal for you, too. Right? Okay. So, but then we get to say this one thing. It's really important what's next. You know, my friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And we get to tell a new guy, you know, when you get to this point, when we get to the second step, you're going to get to choose your own conception, right? It gets to be yours. It don't have to be mine. It don't have to be the one your father or your grandparents or the church or whomever gave you, right? But it's going to have to be something more powerful than you because you've been serving a master and you got to get a new master. So move down a little bit to it was where we get to italicized, right? Paragraph, I think, 4. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. I mean, that's a resounding yes for me. You know, and a question to your new guy can be, hey, are you tired of suffering and living the way you're living, right? Sometimes you got to keep it real simple. I mean, we can get real far out on the ledge of contemplation and pontification and all this stuff, right? But we may just want to keep it real simple at times, especially with a guy you need to get through the work quick so he can get some power, right? And he can get out and start helping somebody else, right? So are you now willing to believe? And we're going to address it again. We're going to ask the question again. But we're going to say, even for our co-founder, man, it started really, really simple, right? Are you now willing to believe that there's something, right, that could help you not suffer the way you've been suffering all this time? Right? Something that could give you freedom from the bondage of alcohol, crack cocaine, whatever it may be. All right, we're going to move over, and then we're going to walk through, we're going to start on page 13, and we're going to kind of walk quickly through, this is what it's going to look like, right, to go through the step work. I always take a new guy back at the beginning. I'll do a thing where when we get to that point where I say, are you willing to go to any lengths, right, after I've qualified him, and I believe he may be real alcoholic or real addict based on some answers he's given me, I will turn over to page 59 and I'll go through a real quick breakdown of what the steps are going to look like, right? And this is, are you willing to go to any links? These are the links, right? This is what it's going to take for you to get free, right? I'm not going to tell you to do any weird, crazy voodoo stuff. I'm going to take you through this thing that was in here way before I have, and millions of people have done it successfully and are sober and stay sober and have better lives because of it, right? This is what it looks like. And that's what, and Bill's going to give us his own breakdown of what that looks like. So, 13, paragraph 2. So Bill, Bill gets separated. So it's important now that with the person that's separated, that they're free, you know, 24, 48, 72 hours free from consumption of alcohol or dope, right? They got a little bit of that shit out of their head. And Bill said, you know, I was separated from it for the last time. It's important. Last time. Very important language. There, I humbly offer myself to God as I then understood God to do with me as he would. We know what this is, right? It's a third step. I place myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. That's a great question for a new guy. Have you been lost? Have you been lost? I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. And we're telling him as we go through what this is, all right? You're going to have to write an inventory where you got to write down about all your resentments, your fears, your conduct in relationships, right? You got to have to face those with me, yourself, and with God, right? And then you're going to have to, once you face them all, you're going to have to ask God to take them away from you, right? That's what's going to happen. Root and branch. Get it out. Take it out. Be gone, right? Be out of me. He then says, my schoolmate visited me. I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. We know that's a fifth step, right? We've told him what we've written down, right? We made a list of people I'd hurt toward whom I felt resentment. That's our eighth step, right? I expressed my entirely willingness to approach these individuals and admit my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to write all such matters to utmost of my ability. So that's a ninth step. I had to go out and make restitution for all the harm. Now, oftentimes a guy will go, whoa, back the bus up, bro. Like, I'm not doing that shit, right? Here's what I say. Okay. So, trust me, there's eight steps that are in front of this step for a reason. So, are you willing to consider that by the time you've gotten to the eighth step, you've got the willingness to go out and make right the harms you've caused? And he'll go, oh, yeah, I think so. That's good enough for me, right? I'm not going to sit around and split hairs with you at this point because I know that scares the shit out of all of us, right? Like, it really does. So just get clear on it. So I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense, right? Very powerful. Talking about psychic change. I'm going to start aligning with the will, like 10th and 11th step. I'm going to start thinking with God consciousness and not my old self-centered consciousness, right? So we're just going to talk to him a little bit about that. We're speaking Greek to him about this, honestly, at this point, right? But we're going to mention it. This is 10th and 11th step work we're talking about here, right? Then we're going to go out and we're going to help other people, right, down at the bottom. So my friend promised that when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator. See, 12 steps says having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. See, that's what we're talking about right there. Boom. Right? See, here's what's going to happen, man. Here's what's possible for you after you've done this. You're going to have a new experience, a new relationship with your Creator of your own choosing. Creator of your own choosing. Not the one I tell you got to have, right? That's the promise. So we're going to hook him. To have a better life. Flipping over to 14. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. Right. So we tell them this program is about the freedom from the bondage of self. Right. We're going to go through a process. It's going to free us from the bondage of self. It's going to turn us out of ourselves into others. Right. And when I say out of ourselves, I mean out of the self-centeredness. Out of self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. All of the things that we've been trapped by, we're going to start to be turned out of so that we can, and like Tarek said in the very beginning, to do the most important thing we can do. We do all this work so that we can go be of service to others. Service to others. Service to others. Service to others. Now this is completely foreign to a new guy. Right? No concept of this. And we just go, okay, trust me. You're going to want to do this, right? You don't have to believe me, you have to trust me, right? The two different things. That I wouldn't lie to you, and that I've done it myself, right? Very good. Okay. So now, let's move over to chapter 2. There's a solution. Where are we at, timeline? All right, so I didn't mark anything. Let me use your book for this one. So now we're going to go and talk for a minute about the difference, because obviously the guy's shown up in the fellowship by now, right? He's got some experience with the fellowship. Maybe he's been around multiple times in and out of the fellowship. Maybe he's one of the poor souls who's been told that actually sobriety is about, or clean, being clean is about coming into the rooms, right? Maybe he's under the false belief that if I just go to meetings, I can stay clean, which maybe all of us have believed at some point or another, right? And we got to understand the new guy coming in, or new gal coming in, is easily going to believe that just because I've shown up here, I'm good, right? Well, the ones of us who know the truth about ourselves know that's not the truth. So, down the bottom, I mean, this is a great paragraph, second paragraph, where it talks about we're all average Americans, and we come from so many different backgrounds, but how we can connect on this level of who we are, right? It says here, the feeling of having shared, in the very bottom of the second paragraph, the feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. So the fact that you and I, like when Tarek tells that story about him and his two buddies leaving the show, coming back, I go, oh yeah, I get that. Like 100%, right? I got story after story of somebody putting down the stem and they're just good. And I'm like, peace out. You know what I'm saying? I'm out, man. Like, I get it. See, that's my people, right? That won't keep us sober. That will not keep us clean. It's one element. We have a common peril. We know the suffering together, the scrounging together, the crumbing together, the stealing together, everything we can do to get another hit. We know that. If that's all we got, we're back out trying to get another hit again. Right. So, one element, and a powerful element in the cement, just not insufficient to keep us here. Okay. So, the tremendous fact for every one of us, is beginning of the next paragraph, is that we have discovered a common solution. So, with a new guy, I'm telling him that, right? You know, the fact, and I, by this time, I've connected with a guy, right? I mean, he's told me enough stories. I've asked enough questions, moving through the doctor's opinion, Bill's story. I know if he's like me, right? Even if he's not exactly like me, but he's pretty close to like me, I've linked up with him, right? Undoubtedly by this point. So it's easy for me to go, you know what, all that stuff that we connected on is not enough for us to stay clean. There's going to have to be something more that goes into that equation that's going to give us freedom. So, and that's what it is. The common solution. So let's move over to page 18, paragraph 4. And I always like this part because by this time you've got somebody, you know, you've got them on the hook when you're working with a new guy typically by here. And if you're properly armed with the facts about yourself, meaning you've done the work, you're clear in what it means for you to be powerless over cocaine or powerless over whatever the other thing may be, right? You're really clear with what your deal is. And you're out doing 12-step work that's clear. So the book says, an ex-problem drinker has found the solution who is properly armed with a fact about himself. Remember back in the doctor's opinion, it says they can rely on anything they say about themselves. So he's talking about the ones of us who are properly armed with the facts about ourselves. We can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic or addict in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. So by this time, we hopefully have won the confidence, right? Because remember, I'm not ever trying to sell a guy, honestly. I'm asking him questions over or her over and over and over again to help them get in touch with their lack of power, choice, and control when it comes to them taking a hit of cocaine or a hit of dope, right? And that has a extremely powerful ability to bring somebody present to what's going on for them. And then once I've been able to do that and craft that with them, a connection occurs. Rapport is built, right? It's there. Although it may be uncomfortable for them to see these things, there's still a connection that occurs. So they trust me. They have confidence that I know what I'm talking about. Right? It's very good. Okay. Okay. So then, as we move over to the top of page 19, we may say to him, you know, if you look at the first paragraph, it says, none of us makes a sole vocation out of its work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. Most of us don't. We actually sit down and just work with guys or gals because it's what we do, right? And it's important for us to say, because you hear sayings in the rooms like, put the plug in the jug, everything's fine, like stuff like that, right? We're going to contradict that with the next statement here. Says, we feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning, or our using is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs, right? So we're going to say, yeah, at first it begins with us just coming in here for the hour and doing what we got to do in the meeting, then working with our sponsor, but that's going to have to expand out, right? That's going to apply to our jobs. It's going to move into our work life, into our home life, to our friendships. And that's not an easy thing. Right, as most of you may know, it's real easy to come in and be Mr. AA for the hour, then go kick the dog or something, right? So, right, like, you know what I mean. So, just to go be an ass, right, so to speak, and not really to show out. So, we're going to talk about the principles don't just exist in the rooms; they start to be applied across our whole life. And at this point, we're just kind of sharing some information as we're moving through. There's a solution because we're starting to talk to the new guy about the solution, right? We've got him in touch with the hopelessness to some degree of his illness, right? The hopelessness of the malady. And we haven't really talked a lot about the malady yet, although we've touched it. We haven't really gone into it, but we have gotten him in touch with some hopelessness, right? Which is good. This is all to the good, right? We want to disturb the new man about his addiction. We want to disturb the new man or woman about their alcoholism. So, and then down at the bottom, now, okay, it's interesting that they stick this here because we're so right in the beginning of the work, and this would take me a long time to be able to remotely exercise, right? But down at the bottom of the page, last paragraph, most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions and our attitudes which make us more useful to others. Right, we want to point this out to him right away, although I don't know if it has a whole lot of effect. Right, this is more of a spiritual transformation place to begin to really have respect and care for other people's viewpoints and opinions. In my experience, maybe you're a person who's naturally more compassionate and able to do that. I'm the opposite of that, not able to do that. So I remember I would read that and go, oh, that's so bizarre, man, like, because it just didn't compute for me, right? Like, it's my way, and the rest of you are doing it wrong, right? And it started pretty early in recovery for me that way, actually. So, although pointing it out and talking to somebody about it is very important, right? Because the new man is going to come up against all kind of difficulties. We know that. We all know this, right? We're turning into a completely new way of life, right? And all that we have by the time we get here is the thinking that we have. And most of us, in some way, are intolerant of other people, right? So to point this out is very valuable, because we can bring them back to it later when they call us up and they're pissed off and they're throwing a fit because somebody's not doing what they want them to do. Okay. All right. Are we on time? Yeah, it's time. Okay, so we'll pause right there. We're going to take a 10-minute break. Then we'll come back and T will pick it back up. Thanks.